Today is Friday, May 1st, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. The U.S. ends federal distancing guidelines in a bid to reopen.
You have about 30 states that are now either in the process of reopening or thinking about it.
Plus, what's it like to be on the front lines in the fight against COVID-19?
The medical surgical floors are still full of patients who are on ventilators.
And why a free press matters. Those stories and more next. U.S. President Donald Trump did not extend U.S. federal coronavirus social distancing guidelines and expressed optimism that states can relax restrictions and reopen their economy at their own pace. Still, some public health experts are concerned of potential consequences. VOA White House correspondent Patsy Wittikuswara starts us off.
Restaurants in the U.S. state of Georgia have joined other businesses that are now allowed to serve customers after a month of lockdown.
We're doing the best we can to follow the guidelines set forth by the governor, by the president.
U.S. President Donald Trump did not extend federal social distancing guidelines that expired Thursday. He expressed optimism states can relax their own restrictions and that the ailing economy will soon rebound.
I think you're going to see economic numbers that are going to be fantastic. I believe it very strongly.
That despite Labor Department figures showing about 30 million Americans filed jobless claims since mid-March. Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell has a more pessimistic outlook than the president.
The ongoing public health crisis will weigh heavily on economic activity, employment, and inflation in the near term and poses considerable risks to the economic outlook over the medium term.
The White House in mid-April released guidelines for states to reopen their economies. Called gating requirements, it's based on a decline in documented coronavirus cases and hospital preparedness, among other factors. Anand Parekh is the chief medical advisor at the Bipartisan Policy Center.
You have about 30 states that are now either in the process of reopening or thinking about it. Probably only a handful actually even meet the initial White House gating requirements there.
President Trump said his administration is working with the private sector to accelerate vaccine development. The nation's top health expert says a drug called remdesivir is showing promise. Director of National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, Anthony Fauci.
The mortality rate trended towards being better in the sense of less deaths in the remdesivir group. 8% versus 11% in the placebo group.
But for right now, before any area or state rushes to reopen, the think tank Bipartisan Policy Center wants communities to keep evaluating their own progress to protect the public's health. Again, Bipartisan Policy Center's Anand Parekh.
Declining cases or the percentage of positive tests in a sustained manner for at least a couple of weeks. The second is increased testing capacity to not only just test individuals who have symptoms, but also vulnerable populations. A third is having a healthcare system that is under capacity. And fourth is, again, having a public health system that can do the important detective work and contact tracing.
Even in states technically still under lockdown, many flout policies to stay indoors, including beachgoers in Southern California. Patsy Wittikuswara, VOA News.
Elsewhere, strict physical distancing restrictions are starting to be wound back across parts of Australia as the number of coronavirus cases fall. Phil Mercer takes things from here.
COVID-19 restrictions vary across Australia. The most significant relaxation of the measures is in the Northern Territory. That territory hasn't recorded any new coronavirus cases for over 3 weeks. Residents will no longer be subject to the 10-person limit for outdoor activities. Fishing and camping are now permitted, and there is no limit on guests at weddings or mourners at funerals. Playgrounds will also be open for the first time in weeks. The rules have also been relaxed in the state of Queensland. Residents there will be allowed to travel up to 50 kilometres from their homes for picnics, boating and motorbike riding with members of their household or just one other person. Shopping for non-essential items such as clothes and shoes will also be allowed, but physical distancing guidelines remain in place. Queensland Premier Anastasia Palaszczuk.
This weekend is also really crucial, so I really hope that everyone acts responsibly that they enjoy some of the lifting of the stay-at-home restrictions, that they can get out and see their family and friends, they can go for a picnic, go for a walk in a national park. If you're doing those recreational activities, it has to be roughly within 50 kilometres of your home. But this is going to be a great opportunity for Queenslanders to really get out and enjoy the fresh air.
New South Wales, the country's most populous state, has suffered more COVID-19 cases than any other Australian jurisdiction. Restrictions imposed to limit the spread of the disease are being slightly eased. The new rules introduced Friday allow people to visit friends in their homes. Most coronavirus regulations in Victoria are expected to remain in place until its state of emergency is lifted on May 11. Residents in Tasmania have also been told to wait for any easing of disease prevention measures on the Southern Island state. The Australian Capital Territory, the region that includes the national capital Canberra, has become the first jurisdiction in the country to be declared free of all known cases of the virus. The federal government says a decision on relaxing national COVID-19 restrictions, including children's sports and recreational sports, will be made Friday, May 8. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
As the number of COVID-19 cases passes 3.25 million people worldwide and more countries are relaxing their stay-at-home orders, what's it like to be at the center of an emergency room during COVID-19? And why would someone volunteer to do this work? How do medical professionals deal with what they see and when they leave work? What about their families? Are they falling apart? VOA's Carolyn Persutti speaks with Dr. Mike Wilson, who moved far from his family to help build a field hospital for coronavirus patients.
In Texas, he and his wife care for their 7 children. In New York City, he cares for hundreds of patients.
This is like our Super Bowl, if I had to say. You know, we spend a lot of time in our career taking care of, you know, maybe some runny noses and sprained ankles and that kind of stuff. But this is the thing that we really train to do.
So when he saw coronavirus videos like these, he knew he had to fly to New York to be on the front lines.
And I wanted my children to know that when whatever it is in their lifetime, that no matter what your politics are, what your religious beliefs are, or whatever, when the balloon goes up and the nation issues a call to help, you don't just sit there.
Wilson helped build his hospital from scratch. It's a bit unsettling for patients who enter a New York field hospital assembled inside a ship, a convention center, or sports stadium. But Wilson also had to adapt when his first 25 patients spoke 5 different languages.
I mean, these are people from the near and the far east. They are dialects of, you know, Muslim countries that I've never even heard of. So just such a vast, rich culture.
He says doctors now better understand the path of the virus, with the crucial time being its 5th to 8th day. Dr. Wilson agrees the curve is flattening, but he worries that big cities may open too soon and a second wave of sickness will shut down the country again.
The medical surgical floors are still full of patients who are on ventilators. Like, there's nobody without a tube in their throat there. The cafeterias are still, housing patients. The ERs aren't full anymore. And, you know, the waiting rooms are probably desolate. But there's still the infrastructure up in the hospital is still on. To some degree, itself is on life support. Like, they can't function as a hospital right now. They're nothing but a COVID center.
Hang in there, and we love you, and we're praying for you. And this is Ernie. He says hi, too.
Video care packages sent from home keep him strong.
Thank you, Mike. Thank you, Mike.
Wilson is in his 4th week of 14-hour shifts without a single day off. He keeps grounded by participating in family routines from his hotel room, not knowing when he'll see his home again.
You know, I FaceTime with the babies. We do, story time. I spend some time with the older kids in the evening. We'll read our scriptures. We say our family prayers. And then once they go to bed, before I go to bed, I spend some time with my wife.
What does Dr. Wilson miss the most? Human touch. No. He has not touched another human being without a glove on for 24 days. Carolyn Persutti, VOA News.
And coming up later,
the main reason we need an independent press is because journalists are vital in helping us make sense of world events. You know, they're there to ask the questions, investigate these allegations of corruption and wrongdoing, essentially just be there to be that watchdog of democracy.
This is VOA News.
Make a difference by honoring ordinary people doing extraordinary things to help one another. VOA encourages you to tell us about everyday people who have shown leadership in your communities during the coronavirus crisis. Submit your nominations to VOA Leaders at voanews.com. Send us your name, phone number, and email, and a VOA reporter will contact you. We're all in this together.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Millions of workers worldwide are marking International Labor Day, trapped between hunger and fear because of the coronavirus pandemic. Many have no job at all or a job without enough health protections. Still, to mark the day, Beijing's Forbidden City cracked open its doors for holiday visitors, and shopping malls from Texas to Indiana in the United States are set up to do the same on Friday. World leaders are trying to find a way to salvage virus-battered economies without unleashing new waves of infections. But some workers and labor unions are worried that it's not safe yet. Traditional May Day marches are curtailed or banned by restrictions on public gatherings, so labor activists are honking horns, singing from balconies, or staging online protests. Now, on yesterday's program, I spoke with David Wilcox, a senior non-resident fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics, about the current state of the economy and to learn why stock markets seem to be rebounding after large sell-offs. Today, we're continuing that conversation and discussing what businesses should be doing now to prepare themselves for economic recovery.
Well, there are tons of examples of really creative innovation, businesses devising very flexible workarounds to help them maintain their book of business, continue to generate some revenue flow. On the other hand, there are other businesses where that's just much more difficult to do. And I think the fundamental reality to keep in mind is that nobody, no matter how creative, no matter how flexible or innovative they are, nobody would have chosen this set of circumstances. For other businesses, there just isn't going to be a pathway to viability through this awful situation, and that's going to be a long-term casualty.
So what kind of impact can that have on an economy if businesses simply can't come back?
We're going to be dealing with the after effects, the echoes of this situation for many years to come. This experience is going to cause structural changes in the way that we do business, in the way that we go about providing goods and services that American firms and households want. And we're only on the going in phase of addressing all of that structural change. And that's going to be very wrenching because it's going to mean that workers need to find jobs with different employers. And it's going to mean that employers need to rethink their business model pretty much from the ground up. So this is going to be a long-term challenge confronting us.
What conversations do you see that are taking place that should?
One, it's clear that one conversation that needs to take place is a thorough rethinking of the pluses and minuses of globalization. And this is a really thorny area that involves a lot of difficult issues. What we're seeing, for example, is a whole new way that globally interconnected supply chains create vulnerabilities for companies. I heard a report just this morning that one reason for the shortage of testing is that the swabs that are used are very specialized, and many of the swabs used around the world were produced in northern Italy. Well, guess what? Northern Italy was an epicenter of the disease, as we all know. So that was a contributing factor to why testing was held back so much here in the United States. I don't think the answer is going to be to bring all that production back on U.S. shores. We gained a lot by trading actively with our international partners. But we're going to need to rethink a lot of the issues on the international dimension. That much is clear.
David Wilcox is a senior non-resident fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. Former U.S. President Joe Biden, who is the presumptive Democratic nominee for president in this year's upcoming November general election, is denying a former staffer's allegation of sexual assault, saying the accusation is not true. Speaking on MSNBC's Morning Joe TV program, Biden made his first comments about the allegation.
I'm confident there's nothing. No one ever brought it to the attention of me 27 years ago. This is any assertion at all. No one that I'm aware of in my campaign, my Senate office at the time, is aware of any such request and or any such complaint.
Reid worked for Biden when he was a U.S. senator from Delaware. Biden said he isn't going to question Reid's motives for bringing up the issue now or attack her for doing so, saying Reid has a right to be heard. Republicans worried about U.S. President Donald Trump's increasingly precarious political standing are seizing on the allegation to portray Democrats as hypocrites who only defend women who allege wrongdoing against conservatives. More than 20 women have accused Trump of inappropriate sexual contact or sexual assault over the past few decades. The Council on American-Islamic Relations, or CARE, has launched an online campaign to educate American Muslims about the coronavirus, to provide guidance against misinformation and advise them on what they should do during the holy month of Ramadan. VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawy spoke with Adnan Haider, professor of global health at George Washington University, about the most important messages he offered the American Muslim community through CARE's campaign.
This is a pandemic. It's affecting over 180 countries. Science is still catching up. We are still trying to figure out how to diagnose the disease. And so there's a lot of concern about science catching up to this disease in terms of treatment. Treatments are being explored. Clinical trials are underway. But science needs time. It needs appropriate methodology. The part that I'm really concerned about is misinformation from community WhatsApp groups and Facebooks indicating that bleach can help you, that gargling with certain things will help you, older drugs can help you. All of this is incredibly important for us to understand. These are not backed by science. There is no evidence for their efficacy. And so I think it's partly our responsibility to ensure that we debunk these types of myths, all the way from thinking that this is something that the world has experienced to conspiracy theories, etc. I think it's really important as a political community, but also as a scientific community, for us to push forward with essential public health prevention measures, social distancing, staying away from mass gatherings, making sure that we look at our lockdown as a mechanism of saving ourselves. And in all societies, in all religions, human life is of primary value. And everything else is in order to protect human life. And so while I completely understand the desire to open up the economy and to go back to work, it is incredibly important for us to understand that that itself can create more cases and more deaths in the future. And so I think for science, this issue is really important. This is a pandemic where science should lead, not politics, and we hope that our leaders will listen more to scientists and physicians and nurses rather than to pundit makers and myth generators.
Some American Muslims used to organize spiritual meetings to study and understand more about their faith, so they may feel it's okay to gather at homes and perform their Ramadan or Friday congregational prayers as an alternative to Islamic centers, which are closed.
I want to make clear that I'm not a religious scholar or a theology professor, right? I'm a professor of public health. So my perspective comes from public health. I think that Ramadan does not mean that the virus is not active. The virus has not decided that during the 30 days of Ramadan, it's somehow not going to be infecting each other. So everything that you were doing pre-Ramadan, you must maintain during Ramadan as well, which means that social distancing must be maintained, that congregations are not allowed. And bypassing that, because our masajid are closed, trying to do alternative communal prayers in your homes or your basements is ill-advised.
Adnan Haider is a professor at George Washington University. He was speaking to VOA's Mohammed El-Shanawi. Sunday, May 3rd is World Press Freedom Day, which has been marked since 1994 after a United Nations General Assembly proclamation. This year's theme is Journalism Without Fear or Favor. I spoke with VOA Press Freedom Editor Jessica Jarit about the challenges facing journalists when reporting on COVID-19 and more.
With the pandemic, really from the start, the pandemic has just been met with censorship, with China, Iran immediately, their response to seeing the outbreak of a pandemic in their country is to try to silence people, put in censorship orders, arrest people who are sort of contradicting what the official line is. And we've seen that spread along with the pandemic. Governments in a range of countries, South Africa, India, across Africa, they are trying to restrict and narrow where this official narrative comes from by saying that you can only ask questions from sort of government-approved health officials or Prime Minister Modi in India. He went, tried to go a step further, and he asked the Supreme Court to request the outlets submit copy for review before publication. And his request was turned down. But it sends this troubling sign to journalists. They feel that some of them may feel that they can't take a risk of trying to step outside of the official narrative just to sort of double check those facts and figures that we need at the moment. Particularly as well, another thing that we've just been seeing is under the sort of guise of emergency measures that a lot of countries have had to enforce with the pandemic, we're seeing countries where you've got authoritarian leaders just trying to consolidate their grip on power. And one of the key countries doing this is in Hungary, where Viktor Orban, for several years now, he's just really been harassing and pushing back against independent media, trying to shut down these few critical outlets that are managing to survive there. And when the pandemic came, his parliament passed a raft of measures just giving him these extraordinary powers, including jailing journalists jailing anyone for up to 5 years for false news. And the government gets to choose what is false news. And already we're seeing cases of journalists there who have been arrested or charged under this law.
Are there any specific regions of the world where you see a growing infraction on the freedom of the press?
Turkey, which has been one of the leading jailers of journalists since 2016, where they had their failed attempted coup, they really push back on this anti-state laws, which just generally means that anyone who's been critical of President Erdogan is just put in prison, accused of trying to disrupt national unity or being part of this alleged coup, when really all the journalists are doing are just reporting critically on the government.
The continent of Africa has 54 nations in it. What about press freedom there?
Yeah, in Africa, we're just seeing a few things, really. There's quite often you see countries who will block internet at key times, whether it's sort of elections, unrest. Liberia was really big on this in June last year when they were seeing protests. Reporters Without Borders, they just released their annual Freedom of the Press Index, and they described Zimbabwe as the biggest press freedom violator in relation to the pandemic. And that's something that we've seen at Voice of America, too, just lots of arrests of journalists who are just going out trying to ask those questions and get the information that everyone needs at this time. And just generally, there's the use, same as other countries, arbitrary arrests and detentions, use of anti-terror laws. Particularly as well in Tanzania, which is sort of backsliding in press freedom. They recently convicted Maxime Mello, who's this editor of Jamii Forums, for refusing to reveal whistleblower identities. And he's been charged with obstruction of a police investigation for just refusing to reveal his sources, which is just such an important part of press freedom and journalism, to be able to protect people who are sort of taking risks to try to share information that they think is vital to other people.
Jessica Jarit is the Press Freedom Editor for The Voice of America. You've been listening to International Edition here on VOA. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser on your phone, your tablet, your desktop computer, or other device to voanews.com. Until next time. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a fantastic Friday and an amazing weekend.